Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
So let's get this straight. It's not a Big Mac. It's not Bernie Mac or Fleetwood Mac. It's Indy Mac that has now gone down in the third largest bank failure in U.S. history. The federal government has taken over Indy Mac to the relief of many, even as it's bailing out Freddie Mac and Fannie Mae with perhaps a $300 billion credit line of tax dollars. So why care about these banks? And are they doing the right thing? Well, here to help us sort out the Macs and the Mays and what it all means to the average Joe is NPR business correspondent Adam Davidson. Hi, Adam. Thanks for doing this with us.
Hey, Brian. Happy to.
Now, most people have at least heard of Freddie Mac and Fannie Mae, even if it's a little vague as to whether they're public or private. They're the big mortgage lenders. But Indy Mac is a new name to many. And suddenly, poof, it's the third largest bank failure ever in the United States. What is Indy Mac?
Indy Mac is, it's a bank like, like any bank that you can think of. They were very...
Really? You mean like it has checking accounts and savings accounts and ATMs?
It's a financial institution that makes loans and I don't know if they have checking accounts, to be totally honest with you. I think of them entirely related to their crucial role in the housing market.
Right.
I'm actually, while we're talking, looking on their website to see if they do.
That's right.
Like they do
I'm not going out to open a checking account at Indy Mac anytime soon.
I would recommend staying away. So they were very involved in the buying and selling of mortgages in bulk. You know, that's the cause of this whole subprime housing crisis, is the fact that there's all these people having mortgages, thinking that the mortgage is owned or that they owe money to whoever sends them a check each month. But, whether it's Bank of America or some local, immigrant bank or whatever. But usually the person who sends them the check doesn't own their mortgage. They've sold it to someone like Indy Mac, who's bundled it and sold it on to some big investment bank on Wall Street, like Bear Stearns or Goldman Sachs or whatever, who then cuts it up into a million pieces and sells it to investors all over the world. So Indy Mac was a crucial part of that process. By all accounts, they were one of the more irresponsible ones. This was between, say, 2002 and 2006.
Mm-hmm.
If you were a bank that wanted to grow fast and make a fortune, make a lot of money, there was a really easy way to do it, which was to pay a lot less attention to risk and just get deeper and deeper into the subprime mortgage world. Because basically what was happening is hundreds of billions of dollars of mortgage loans were going to people who never owned mortgages before. So if you think by, say, early 2003, everyone in America outside of New York City, we should say, because New York's a weird place where housing prices are huge. But everyone else who had any reason, was at all a reasonable bet for owning a home, owned a home. So they wanted to expand. They started lending to people who were not reasonable bets, the subprime borrowers.
Right. And money was made on this bundling. And I want to move on to another piece of it.
Yeah, yeah.
Because I think that part is actually fairly familiar. What does the federal government takeover mean? Does it mean everyone with money in the bank is actually safe this morning?
Now, the FDIC thing is the Indy Mac situation is a totally different thing from Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. So Indy Mac, it's just the regular, every one of us who has a checking account or savings account, we are paying an insurance premium effectively somehow and all the fees and stuff we pay our bank for. We're paying for an insurance contract with the government, and now Indy Mac's, the people who have money in Indy Mac are getting the insurance. So, like your house burns down, you've paid for that insurance, and now you get the check because your house burned down. Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac are a totally different thing. This was a big gray area. These were two companies, basically in the 30s and then again in the 50s, the U.S. government wanted to have more people owning houses. It was a political decision that, left alone to its own devices, the market would not create enough homeowners. The government wanted there to be more homeowners, but the government didn't want to get into the business of actually buying and selling homes or having mortgages and stuff. So they set up these two private companies with kind of a rumor or a whisper or a suggestion that the U.S. government will always back those two private companies. That lowered the risk level and made banks more comfortable lending to people, and that dramatically increased the amount of homes owned in America, which the U.S. government decided
right.
was a good thing.
Because it pushed down the interest rates.
It kept the interest rates low, and it also extended loans to people who would not otherwise have been able to get them.
So then in this rare Sunday night move last night, the Federal Reserve announced a bailout for Freddie Mac and Fannie Mae. It's estimated to be worth up to $300 billion of credit to those banks. How is that any different from what you just described, the federal guarantees that you just described going back to the 1950s?
Well, the federal guarantees were never defined. No one ever really said what the government owed Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. So here's the thing. Let me put it simply. The federal government created two private companies to benefit the society as a whole.
Mm-hmm.
So right now, the federal government's role should be to protect the society as a whole. Now, there also are these private investors in Fannie and Freddie, people who have put their own money into stocks. They are not society as a whole. They should be punished, not punished badly, but they should lose all their money because they invested in a company that wasn't any good. It's not their fault, but that's the way markets work. If you invest in Apple and tomorrow Apple becomes horrible and its value goes to zero, no one should bail you out.
But in this case, Paul Krugman in his column today, for example, says Fannie and Freddie had nothing to do with the explosion of high-risk lending like Indy Mac did. In fact, they faded from the scene during the housing bubble. Is that
faded
true?
Faded is a little strong. I mean, they're still the dominant housing institution in the world. But yes, they had much stricter rules than the subprime. I mean, by definition, actually, a subprime loan is one that Fannie and Freddie didn't back. They are kind of the safe base note to the U.S. housing industry.
So if they weren't backing subprime loans, why are they getting creamed?
Well, ask Chuck Schumer. That's part of it. No, because he destroyed Indy Mac, maybe. We don't know. But he also has been beating up on Fannie and Freddie. The problem is, first of all, it doesn't matter. I mean, stock markets are not always rational beasts. Stock prices don't always go up and down for purely rational business reasons. But the government should not be in the business of caring about stock prices. That's my main point. The government should not care if people who own stock in Fannie and Freddie lose money. That is not the government's problem. The government's problem may be the stability of the overall U.S. housing crisis, but this $300 billion bailout is protecting those stockholders rather than allowing those stockholders to be zeroed out and then taking the next step.
And that doesn't trickle down to protection for homeowners?
Oh, it does, but it's I was talking to someone at NPR this morning on Morning Edition off air, and I was sort of saying there's option A and option B. So option A, so you have a potential crisis. Fannie and Freddie may either disappear or lose a lot of value or whatever. So option A is we pay all of the cost right now, and it's a severe cost. If Fannie and Freddie are dramatically reduced as economic forces in the country, then you have the housing markets will effectively seize up and prices will collapse.
Yeah.
I might be able to buy a place in Manhattan, you know, if this goes too far because there will be so much fewer mortgages. That will hurt.
It's a good thing. Kidding.
For us. But that'll trickle through the economy. It'll be painful. The whole economy will slow down. It'll be miserable for a couple years. But 10 years from now, 20 years from now, whoever's the head of Goldman Sachs or Fannie and Freddie will know, hey, if I screw up, I pay the price. And stockholders will say, if I screw up, I pay the price. And so they'll be more careful and more rational. Option B is the option that the government's choosing, which is let's bail them out, just like we bailed out Bear Stearns. Let's save the day, prevent the short-term crisis. But then 10 years from now, stockholders are going to say, hey, I'm going to allow Fannie and Freddie, or whoever survives and becomes the new Fannie and Freddie, to take more risk, to do more crazy stuff, to make money, because if worst-case scenario, government's going to come in and bail them out.
Right.
That's a very dangerous situation.
Now, but I'm going to throw in a headline here that just came in from the AP. President Bush is going to lift the executive ban on offshore drilling. Now, this controversy has been around in the presidential campaign. John McCain walked away from his long-term opposition to offshore drilling off the domestic United States. And President Bush has now lifted the executive ban that, ironically, his father, the first President Bush, had placed in 1989, 1990. So President Bush to now lift the executive ban on offshore drilling. That just means that it's going to be up to the states. Now, Arnold Schwarzenegger was on television yesterday saying, thank you very much for the option. We're going to choose not to exercise it in California. But at least we now know President Bush is officially lifting the executive ban on offshore drilling. That just in. And we just have a few minutes left with NPR business correspondent Adam Davidson. One other thing, I want to play a Chuck Schumer quote in a minute because you mentioned him, and he's at the center of some controversy regarding IndyMac. But just let me clarify one thing. This $300 billion credit line, that's not the same as giving someone $300 billion. This is only if they can't meet their obligations. So if they're really healthier than the irrational market is perceiving them, as I think you suggested, does this actually cost the taxpayer anything?
All right. So I don't know if they're healthier, by the way. There's a chance they are.
Yes.
Just don't know. So, yes, I mean, what the message of that $300 billion is to tell the market, hey, calm down. There's not going to be a run on this institution. They're going to survive because we're going to make sure they survive. So that will strengthen them. That will keep them alive. That will raise their stock price, as I was saying. The direct cost, so yes, if Fannie and Freddie had to borrow that $300 billion, that would be a direct cost. And it also, the biggest cost would be inflation, because suddenly you have $300 billion new dollars flooding the U.S. economy, and that's a lot of money. That can really cause inflation.
Mm-hmm. Billion here, billion there.
Which is a real cost. I mean, just remember, the fiscal stimulus package was half that.
Mm.
And so that is a cost. I would argue that possibly the bigger cost is this moral hazard cost I was just talking about. The much bigger cost is the message this is sending to investors and pension funds and banking institutions, this too big to fail idea that take big risks. So we don't know what the next bubble is going to be. We've
mm-hmm.
had two in rapid succession.
Right.
And so
go ahead, because it's privatizing profits while socializing loss. So you let investors reap the windfalls when high-risk banking works out, but you make the taxpayers eat some of the losses if it doesn't.
Which is exactly the opposite of what you'd want to do. You'd want to privatize loss, or you want, I mean, basically a market functions when every player in the market bears the full cost of their bad decisions and gets the full reward of their good decisions. And when you mess with that in either direction, you create distortions.
Right.
And
although the question for the moment is that too much theoretical economics? And is it really too big to fail because just too many people would get hurt in their individual lives? And that's obviously the political decision that surrounds the economic one. Let me just play this Chuck Schumer clip because federal official in charge of IndyMac is blaming Schumer for that bank's failure because Schumer made a public comment last month expressing concern about its solvency. That spooked depositors into a bank run. They withdrew more than $1 billion in a matter of days. And so did Chuck Schumer cause this failure by having too big a mouth?
The breadth and depth of the problems of IndyMac were created and apparent for years, and they accelerated in the last 6 months.
And he says he didn't say anything that wasn't already on the public record. Before you go, Adam, do you have any opinion about that?
I mean, I'd say on the one hand, he is right. I mean, you know, people who follow this, I've known that IndyMac is in serious trouble for a lot longer than 6 months. I mean, that's not a secret. Everyone knew. The idea is that that pessimism about IndyMac's future was effectively priced into the market. Everyone knew it, so that's why their stock price was lower. That's why they had to pay more to get loans. It was priced into the market. The new information that Chuck Schumer provided is that what has become the true banker of last resort, the U.S. Congress, is really cynical about IndyMac and might let them collapse. And Chuck Schumer is a very powerful figure. He runs the Joint Economic Committee from the House and the Senate. He is one of the defining figures, most powerful people in the U.S. economy. And when someone of that stature says something like that about a bank, it changes the picture completely. Mm. So, yeah, of course he's right. People knew it was in trouble. But they didn't know that Chuck Schumer was probably going to let it fail and wasn't going to do anything and saw the problem as entirely IndyMac.
And now the federal government has not let it fail, having taken over IndyMac, and that's where we leave this primer for today with NPR business correspondent Adam Davidson. Thanks a lot, Adam.
Thank you, Brian. Always very fun.
More economics in a minute, but this time it's the dollar value of the All-Star Game to New York City and the Steinbrenners, with a few other stadium economics and controversies thrown in, with sports economist Andrew Zimbalist. Coming up in a minute, Brian Lehrer on WNYC.